Okay, let me first thank the organizers for inviting me to tell a bit about our results in Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara, you can actually easily give a nice 15-minute talk about Santa Barbara herself, who was a saint who lived in the 4th century, but I'll stop at that. Anyway, that's her. I'm not Catholic, so I don't really believe in her, but it's just for your information. But let's see, is there a pointer somewhere? Oh, yeah. The title here is not the same as in the program. The title that is in the program was given to me by the organizers, and they actually took it from a paper in Nature, which we published last year, where again that title had been given to us by the editors of Nature. But I'll give you the content in any case. So what I want to talk about is what we hope to derive or think we can see in optics doing optical techniques. So the optical techniques we use are both reflectivity experiments, where you reflect light on a sample and then you compare the reflected light intensity as a function of frequency by light reflected from a perfect mirror, or at least from a known mirror, in this case gold, which you do by evaporating gold on the same sample surface. This way you calibrate at each frequency the absolute reflectivity, and that gives reflectivity curves like those shown here, in this case for the bismuth 3-layer HTC superconductor. Another technique, and we actually use a combination of the two, is ellipsometry, where you reflect polarized light on your sample and you study or you analyze the state of polarization using a second polarizer or analyzer, the state of the polarization again for each frequency of the reflected light. This is called ellipsometry, and you can use it by using this analyzing technique. This here is the intensity as a function of analyzer angle, which gives you two numbers. The two numbers correspond to the two ellipsometric parameters, the long and the short axis of the ellipse and its orientation, and feeding that into the Fresnel formula, which is given over here, you get the real and imaginary part of the dielectric function, where the imaginary part is related to the so-called optical conductivity that we always like to plot. So an example of that is given over here. It's often indicated as epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, also as a function of frequency, which you get directly from the ellipsometry without having to use any kind of Kramers-Kronig relations. The quantity of interest for us is the optical conductivity. It's just the current divided by field. It has a nice, this expression you'll have to look up later on the web if you're interested and want to calculate optical conductivities. In any case, it has a crystal clear theoretical meaning. The recipe of what you have to calculate is very clear. It's a little bit difficult to do it very exactly, and that's because it involves a Hamiltonian in the sort of Green's function that it is, which has also interactions in it, and that means that the calculation itself is rather complicated. Now, this is an example for two different compounds, the 3-layer and the double layer compound of bismuth 2-1 of the bismuth cuprate. For different temperatures, the optical conductivity has a Drude-like rise as you go to low frequencies, which is suppressed due to the presence of a gap, or sometimes even above TC, a pseudo-gap, when the system becomes either superconducting or enters this pseudo-gap state. Now, for the two compounds, since I showed them here, this is not in this Nature paper, this is much more recent work, you see that the conductivities are actually quite close to each other, but not identical. The 3-layer compound has a somewhat higher optical conductivity, but follows the same trends. And here we have the real part of the dielectric function in an enhanced plot close to the plasma frequency, close to where it crosses zero. You can see that the plasma frequency of the 3-layer compound is a little bit higher than a double-layer compound, as you would expect. But in every other aspect, these things have more or less the same characteristics. Now, a quantity that people like to look at a lot in the cuprates if you do optics is the so-called frequency-dependent scattering rate and the frequency-dependent mass. You can do it because the optical conductivity has an The low frequency part of the spectrum can be given by a sort of a Drude function, and you can actually generalize that Drude function by attributing a frequency dependence to the scattering rate. But if you do it, you also have to include a frequency dependent mass to be fully consistent, and this actually corresponds to putting in a sort of a self energy to your quasi-particles in the expression, if you still have quasi-particles. So in a quasi-particle picture, it really is possible by inverting the optical conductivity and taking its real part by extracting the frequency-dependent scattering rate, and also by taking its imaginary part to obtain the frequency-dependent mass. Both functions have a prefactor, which is just a constant, which you have to determine in another way, for example, by using the F symbol. Here I give a few examples of non-HTC superconductors. They are not in this community. They are probably interesting. It's pure cerium in the alpha and the gamma phase. The alpha phase is the low temperature phase, which is it's believed to be a Kondo system, a Kondo liquid system. And there you see indeed that 1 over tau rises as you go up in temperature and then reaches a plateau. And more maybe significantly, you find that at low frequencies there is an enhancement of the mass, which is not present in the gamma phase. It's not a huge enhancement, but there is a dynamical enhancement of the mass. If you do the same for manganese silicide, which is also sort of intermediate mass heavy fermion system, or somewhat heavier fermion system, you also find that the mass at low temperatures increases and reaches a maximum around over here of about 5 times its value at high frequencies, and that effect disappears as you go to higher and higher temperatures. The same you find back in the scattering rate. The scattering rate rises. It's maybe interesting to note in this case that the scattering rate and the mass have shapes. In this case, it's not really a parabolic rise, but it is the curvatures in the opposite sense. Which is not so in cerium. Here you could imagine in any case that was in the resolution that we have, that it's really parabolic, it's really a parabola, and it's even clearer in the effective mass. So this would be a Fermi liquid-like system in the alpha phase, and here manganese silicide, you may put a question mark whether on this scale where we do the experiment, it is really a Fermi liquid. If you have another few favorites of this community, the cerium, iridium, indium 5, the same rhodium and cobalt. This is here a non-superconducting material. It's antiferromagnetic. The other two are superconducting materials, and you find that the two superconducting examples have a very strong and very clear low temperature effective mass increase. The dots are extrapolations where you also use the known DC resistivities of these compounds. So these ones are heavier fermions again. It's apparently not the case in the antiferromagnetic sample, which does not become superconducting at low temperatures, and maybe there is a real relation between this mass enhancement effect that you find here and their superconductivity. And again, that has its counterpart in the scattering rate, which has also a parabolic rise and then reaches a sort of a plateau value.
So what are the rates of these noise?
Sorry?
Noise from the curves.
Well, part of it, there's a bit of phone. No, this is just noise. That's a long story. this is actually just noise. It's in this case present because there are some windows in the cryostat, and these windows, in this particular case, were very thin foils of a sort of plastic. No, it's not shot noise. It's Fabry-Pérot resonances in those windows. In the meantime, we have replaced those windows with diamond windows, which do not have this problem, and we have much less noise. It's not real noise in that sense. Yeah, so it tells you that at very low frequencies, where your mass has been fully renormalized, the scattering is suppressed. And once you go to higher frequencies, then the inverse happens. You scatter now from the stuff that causes your mass renormalization at low frequencies. That's a rather general property, by the way, of a self-energy correction also. Now we go to the cuprates. Again, we have 1 over taus that, in this case, at low temperatures, there is the effect of the gap. But ignoring that for a moment, you see that the scattering rate rises. more or less linearly as you go up in frequency, and if you look at a mouse, it rises in the opposite sense. So if you go down in frequency, it increases, not dramatically, but you shouldn't forget that the rise is also intercepted by the occurrence of a pseudo gap at around 100 Kelvin in these two samples. It's 88 Kelvin here and 108 Kelvin over there. So the question is this something that we should interpret as a Fermi liquid or not? And maybe because it's almost linear, or it's even curved a little bit in the opposite sense, this is a case where probably the Fermi liquid behavior is simply not there. It's not a Fermi liquid. So the old idea of the margin of Fermi liquid seems to apply. Here you have a 1 over tau, which increases more or less linearly as a function of temperature, and the mass has the opposite curvature. With a small footnote, I don't know really how important it is, but the curvature is a little bit in the opposite sense already. So it's slightly worse than marginal, maybe. On the other hand, maybe that can be cured also with just some log corrections to the scattering rates and shouldn't be so worrisome. Another idea, which is not related but has a related outcome, came from Phil Anderson. He used the Luttinger liquid idea, which turned out not to be correct even for one dimension, but the idea is there nonetheless, saying that sigma should be given by some kind of a power law, where this coefficient alpha is a coefficient which characterizes the Luttinger liquid. If you then calculate 1 over tau star, which is not really the same as 1 over tau, it's 1 over tau times the mass linearization factor, that again is a function which is linearly proportional to the frequency. So at least the result is more or less the same. So indeed, if you make a plot of this 1 over tau star, you find that it is much more perfectly linear. Again, there are a few bumps on the road, and these are just systematic problems of the experiment. It's a very old and very well-known result that on a very broad range, up to 1 electron volt, you see this linear behavior of 1 over tau star. But we shouldn't forget, if you make the plot of 1 over tau, it has a curvature rather than being precisely linear. So the question you may ask then, is this related to having a quantum critical point? Well, not doing so bad. Okay, you may argue that if you have a quantum critical point, then you should have quantum critical dynamics in all the spectroscopic properties, including the optical conductivity. And quantum criticality would then mean that you have a timescale invariance. This should certainly apply in the quantum regime, namely for a regime where the temperature is smaller than the frequency that you try to probe. So having timescale invariance implies that sigma should be given by a power law, and because you also have to satisfy Kramers-Kronig relations, there's a power law with a phase factor for your conductivity, where the phase factor itself is already known also. It's actually given by the Kramers-Kronig constraints of your system. In other words, your conductivity should be given by minus I omega to some power. This was actually precisely the form that Phil Anderson got also, but based on different considerations. So there are two ways of getting out this power from your deck, from your spectra. One way is to look at the power law of the at the frequency dependence of sigma itself. And the other way is by looking at the phase of the conductivity, which should be independent of frequency and should give you your power law directly also. The phase should be constant. So this is an example. If you make a plot of a log plot of the amplitude of the conductivity, you find that in a certain frequency range, it's about one order of magnitude range, a little bit more, you find a linear behavior of all the curves on a log-log scale, and from it you can read off what the power is, and it gives you gamma is 1.35, or a power which is minus 2/3 for sigma. And if you look at the phase, you find that in the same region the phase is actually constant, and the value of the phase again gives you a gamma of 1.33 in this case. So there's a consistency between those two methods, both agreeing that you have a power law. Also, you find that the phase is actually quite sensitive to the opening of a gap. If you go to low temperatures, But not yet in the superconducting state. You see that there's already a bit of a rise of the phase away from its constant value, and that is an indication of the opening of the gap, where you get less, where the response becomes maximally inductive rather than or dispersive rather than absorbing. This here is a review of an overview of many different compounds with different dopings. The dopings are indicated over here, and you find that typically for optimally doped and lightly overdoped, you find this constant phase, always corresponding to a power which is 2/3. If you go underdoped, you start to find departures from that behavior. And the bismuth 2201, which turns out to be a very strongly underdoped sample, there's a low TC, is clearly not a constant anymore. So it seems to be tied, this constant phase, to the optimal doping. There's a point about UV regularization that I want to skip because there's probably just 2 minutes left now. But there is actually a serious problem as well, and that is if you go in the opposite regime, where temperature is much higher than frequency, you would expect to find a scaling behavior normally if it's quantum critical. And the scaling, you can easily predict what the scaling should look like. First of all, temperature should be the only energy scale. It was already the marginal Fermi liquid idea of Varma. And implying that rule and demanding that you should have scaling, the scaling function should be T to the power Y for the conductivity times a function which only depends on the ratio, frequency divided by temperature. The question is, what value of Y should we have? Well, if we are justified in believing that there should be a sum rule, in other words, that the conductivity in the scaling part should not depend on temperature, for example, that would require that this Y equals minus 1. I'm not 100% sure whether this is justified, but this is one way to arrive at a certain answer. So if Y equals minus 1, then we find that 1 over T times sigma 1 should be, again, a scaling function of omega over T. And if you just series expand that function and only take the even powers of that series expansion, and there's a reason for doing it, that's again Kramers-Kronig, the conductivity should always be an even function of frequency, so only the even components should survive, then just taking the first two terms, this is the behavior that we expect to find for 1 over t times sigma 1, universal function of omega over t. There's a note to make here, also in relation to what I said over there. In two dimensions, Fisher, Grinstein, and Gervin derived a different scaling function which has y equals 0. And actually that means that apparently you cannot obtain scaling functions which do not satisfy this F-sum rule, and maybe in a more rigorous way than what I derived over here.
But it's not clear that this is a Maxwell-Schwarzschild transition at all.
No,
so
it's not.
It doesn't apply to any transition, just to the Maxwell-Schwarzschild.
Yeah, but F-sum rules are more general than that.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, sure. That's absolutely agree. Yeah. So here we plot now the h-bar, the function I just mentioned, 1 over t times sigma, as a function of omega over t. And you find that for a reasonable range, but not the highest frequencies, you find that they all collapse on one curve. And that curve corresponds very nicely to the Taylor series expansion I just mentioned, with a prefactor A, which is of the order 1, and that's also seems also to be quite reasonable. So from it you may conclude that we have, at least for the low omega over t region, a sort of a Drude behavior with a scattering rate which is proportional to temperature itself. Well, this last thing that we knew already, that it was also given by a Drude function, is maybe not so widely realized. You can use that knowledge to exclude certain possibilities. For example, Joffe and Millis predicted the cold spot model with the following conductivity formula. Sigma is constant divided by the square root of t squared minus I omega times some constant. And this formula would give you scaling behavior, which is a function of omega over t squared. This is clearly what we do not see. So the cold spot model and similar models can actually be excluded on those bases. So that leads me to the summary of what we spoke about. The optical scattering rate of the optical scattering rate of the cuprates is slightly sublinear, but roughly linear in any case. The optical conductivity below 5,000 or 6,000 inverse centimeter follows a power law, and that power law is a two-third power. The low temperature behavior is masked by the pseudo gap in the optical conductivity, and that means that we can't make statements about the low frequency behavior, and actually cannot follow quantum critical behavior or check quantum critical behavior down to the region where we are really interested in it. This is maybe a way of saying that it's not there. The 2D metal insulator scaling behavior of the conductivity is not observed. In contrast, we find something that looks like a Drude behavior with a scattering rate which is linear as a function of temperature. And then there's a second region in frequency space, the higher frequency, frequency larger than temperature, where we have these power laws which are nicely confirmed. It's not clear whether these two things, in fact, you find no conclusion here about whether it's quantum critical or not. So I leave that for the discussion also, and you can find more details in this paper in Nature. Thank you for your attention.
What's the local leaning towards this? What is the power of observed behavior?
Omega over T?
No, what is the power of observed?
That's around 800 inverse centimeters. So that is about 800 Kelvin.
I think it was a larger one.
Well, it actually depends on temperature. So that's if you go to the lowest temperature, maybe this is a good example. It's about, well, actually, I would say the limit where you can still see it at the lowest temperature, which is still not superconducting, is about 800 or so, 700. But that's Kelvin. So that's much larger. That's a very high scale of energies indeed, much higher than TC itself also. Yeah. But we shouldn't forget that the gap, of course, is of the order of six times TC also.
Chandra?
I want to say a couple of general things. I think the statement that T is the only scale for the fault means that you are looking at the composition exactly, the critical composition, and that you are looking at the critical mode, and that you're looking at the energy below some cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It will always be ordinary everyday physics coming in at high energy, so when it's only the singular part.
Mm-hmm.
And second thing is that in your scaling form, and we have discussed this before, this one.
But this is more for the other people then, yeah.
That you have a form which you have written the T to the gamma f of omega over T.
Mm-hmm.
But you know from experiment what that gamma is. It's one.
Yeah.
From the experiment.
Yeah.
So given that the functional dependence on omega, one can either say that you're not near the critical point, or your gamma or your omega dependence cannot be terribly different from one, or you're not looking at the critical mode. You have two-thirds of not equal to one.
Yeah.
So there are all these caveats.
Okay. So, but you would agree that...
I'm saying that some of the fits are over, 6,000 centimeter inverse, which I'm not quite clear what the upper cutoff should be in the data. You had a change of functional form, if I remember.
Yeah, I didn't show it here, but... so it's a change of functional...
Then, I'll come to that in my part. It's wonderful that conductivity is almost, behaving like omega or T, but if it's not the critical mode, I don't believe it is, then one should be... so it's not exactly the same story as to But what I'm saying is that right now, fitting to a scaling form, you're saying that it's not working.
Well, maybe one way to interpret this is to say, okay, we have really two contributions to the spectrum. The one that satisfies the scaling formula is actually just the Drude formula.
There's something else which is coming in at beyond some energy and slowly rising.
Right. Yeah. And this other stuff is the cause of seeing this quasi-linear scattering rate. But actually, maybe you, I mean, experimentally it's not really possible to separate these things, of course, except by looking in different frequency ranges. In the range where you might expect reasonably well to find to observe the quantum critical behavior, that is for low frequencies below a few times TC, it looks like the proper formula is just the Drude function, basically scattering rate which is proportional to T, plus something else. So there's another component. Which gives you this at higher frequencies this scattering rate this power law behavior. That may be one way to interpret it, just to split it up in two. That the resistivity is proportional to T?
That's your frequency. Your scaling doesn't work out with
your frequency. Question. No. In fact, the scaling itself works very well at low frequencies. Let me see if I can find it. So that's over here. Okay. This is an omega over T plot for different temperatures. So the lowest we got. Yeah. So that's quite low. But of course, here we are talking about the part below where most of the spectral that you see are below 800 inverse centimeter.
So this is not the beginning, you see a two-thirds power.
Exactly, that's the whole point. Yeah, so you see two-thirds power that may be totally unrelated to quantum criticality, actually. Yeah, I think if anything is related to quantum criticality, it would have to be this function here, because that's the correct regime. That's also true, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
but that's very high frequencies.
I know. Well, not on electronic scale.
No, that's also true.
TC, mm-hmm.
It's much.
You expect TC to be this, small, low energy scale,
mm-hmm.
obscuring this quantum critical point.
But so the problem is that we have a scaling function in some part of the omega over T regime. And then it stops. The scaling doesn't work anymore if you go to higher frequencies. In fact, I only showed up to here, but it gets really very bad if you go above 3. And that's roughly, of course, it depends on temperature now because it's omega over T. But that's more or less the regime where you have this nice power law. And I've been talking with all these people, several of them, again and again. And actually, we don't figure out a way to how to fit those two together. It seems that it doesn't scale, but you do have a power law.
It doesn't scale. What's all that?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, anyone else?
I'm so happy.
Can you try the scaling in different ways? If you take a frequency dependent connectivity, temperature dependent, there's a scaling. They scale, you know, fit one up to the other.
Well, that's more or less what I did, because by plotting 1 over, I mean, this T here is just the resistivity itself, because in, for this particular compound, it is the same thing, apart from a factor.
Could you see the small error bars on 2/3 value? Is this really zero?
Oh, it's 2/3, so 0.66 plus or minus 0.3 or 0.0, so 0.03.
Does it depend on what material?
Slightly, yeah. In fact, you can see that in this survey I gave. It's a nice picture, but not related to this talk. Okay, so you may say the 2/3 is roughly this angle also, times 90. So about 60 here, it's 60 there, but plus or minus a couple of degrees. Yeah, it's quite robust, even in. So if you go from one compound to the other, it may vary from 0.55 to 0.7. That's more or less the range. And if it's beyond that, you get things like this, where it isn't really constant anymore for completely different dopings.
Okay, anything else? Well, I guess we can break for coffee. We need to be back here at 10:30. Okay.